Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, the only moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto. It's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casinos, the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
On the morning of August 27th, 2009, a man walking his dog made a devastating discovery at Caldwell Fields, a campground in the Jefferson National Forest near Blacksburg, Virginia. In a parking area, two Virginia Tech students, 18-year-old Heidi Childs and 19-year-old David Metzler, had been shot and killed. Just 12 hours earlier, the couple had gone to the campground to talk and spend time together. They were expected to return home that night, but they never did. More than 16 years later, the murders of Heidi and David remain unsolved, and detectives are still searching for the person or people responsible, as well as why they decided to take two innocent lives. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, that's what we do here, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. This case, Heidi and David, is going to be one of those instances where, for the most part, law enforcement has been pretty tight-lipped about certain things. They have made a lot of public statements, and we're going to get into that tonight. But I feel like a lot of what they said requires you to read between the lines, and I'm hoping with my investigative background, I can help us all decipher what they're actually saying without saying it. But this is a tragic case. These two young individuals had their whole lives ahead of them, and they were a couple, and a lot of people believed that they would eventually get married. And yet some scumbag or scumbags happened to be in the same area as them on this particular day, and unfortunately, they decided to take their lives for absolutely no reason whatsoever. And this case has received some public attention, although I must confess, I had never heard about it before until it came to my attention. So here we are, 16 and a half years later, and we still don't have answers. And I'm hoping with some of the stuff that we're going to talk about at the end of this episode tonight, that maybe we can get this ball moving again and finally solve this case. We have a lot to cover. I don't want to waste any more time. Let's dive into this week's case. In the late 2000s, the Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University, commonly referred to as Virginia Tech, experienced a series of unimaginable tragedies. On April 16, 2007, a Virginia Tech student killed 32 students and faculty members on the Blacksburg campus before taking his own life. Then on January 21, 2009, another student attacked and beheaded a fellow student with a kitchen knife inside the university's Graduate Life Center. And just months later, on August 27, 2009, two Virginia Tech students were found murdered at Caldwell Fields, a campground in the Jefferson National Forest. The area is located in northern Montgomery County, around 15 miles from campus. And this particular location that we're going to be talking about tonight sits just off Craig Creek Road, near a shooting range and Camp Tuckaway. According to the Richmond Times-Dispatch, Caldwell Fields is a popular campground with the Virginia Tech students and other locals. It's made up of fields that are often filled with wildlife. People regularly camp, hike, fish, and take photographs in that area, and residents living around that community tend to pay attention to what's happening on a day-to-day basis. Cars that drive by, loiterers, things like that, they like to keep their finger on the pulse of that area, and this is something common that you see throughout the country. If you have a particular area that's frequented by outsiders or people who don't live in that specific neighborhood, you're going to have the local residents want to keep an eye on what's going on there because they don't want all that. They don't want all the partiers. They don't want all the transients. They don't want people who are up to no good coming in and causing problems. Now, some people may say that sometimes they step over that a little bit and they can become Karens a little bit. But overall, this is not something that's uncommon. We see it everywhere we go where if you step into a certain neighborhood and you're not from there, you may have a local resident approach you and say, hey, who are you? What are you doing here? Sometimes it can offend you, but at the end of the day, I always looked at it as, hey, they're just looking out for themselves and their neighbors. And so it does happen, and apparently it was happening here as well. And while this area would be considered by most to be remote, it also was a place where people are frequently coming and going. And if you look at the map that I have up on the screen, if you're watching on video right now, you can see Craig Creek Road. And then if I zoom in a little bit, there's Caldwell Fields. And then if I zoom back out, you can kind of see the overview of Craig Creek Road. So I hope that kind of gets my point across, what I'm trying to depict here, although it's kind of a contradictory statement. Yes, you can definitely get lost there, but also there's a lot of people down there conducting different activities. Some of them good, maybe some of them not so great. So at around 8 a.m. on August 27th, 2009, a man walking his dog discovered two bodies in the parking area at Caldwell Fields. One body was inside a Navy 1992 Toyota, and the other was on the ground outside the car. The man immediately called 911, and when deputies with the Montgomery County Sheriff's Office arrived, they determined that both victims had suffered gunshot wounds. Now, it's important to note that there was no weapon left behind, so deputies were able to deduce pretty quickly that this was a double homicide. This was not a murder-suicide situation, or the firearm would still be there, and yet it wasn't. So we know that there's at least one more party involved here, and clearly they didn't stay behind to speak with authorities. And I know right now, because I've been with you guys for a while, that everyone's asking, okay, but where were they shot? What was the location of the gunshot wounds? How many times were they shot? And up to this day, as I'm sitting here right now speaking with you, law enforcement has never said where the victims were shot or how many times. They've only described the scene as, quote, brutal and ugly. But that can mean a lot of things, and that's open to interpretation. What does brutal and ugly mean? Does that suggest that they were shot multiple times, or were they each shot once in the face? I would rather them come out with that information, but I also understand why they haven't. And you guys do as well. We've talked about it over numerous cases. Guilt knowledge, right? They're trying to keep some stuff in-house so that if they find someone who comes forward with credible information, this is a question they can ask to verify what they have to say. And if they give that out to the public, they lose that ability to do so. And us knowing that information, although we would like to have all the facts so we can kind of theorize on what happened here, it's not necessarily important for the general public. And that's just the reality. The victims were identified as 18-year-old Heidi Childs, who was found outside the car, and 19-year-old David Metzler, who was found inside the vehicle, which belonged to him. Heidi Lynn Childs was born on December 9, 1990, to her parents Laura and Don, who was a sergeant with the Virginia State Police. She came from a tight-knit family and was one of eight children. From the moment she was born, Heidi had a smile on her face, and because of that, her family nicknamed her Smiley. Heidi was homeschooled growing up, and at 16, she began taking college prep classes and was soon accepted at Virginia Tech on a full scholarship where she studied biochemistry. By August 27, 2009, she was a sophomore, and the semester had just started a few weeks earlier, and Heidi had recently moved into an off-campus apartment with five friends. Heidi had been dating David Metzler for about a year, though they had known each other much longer. They were both from the Lynchburg, Virginia area, and they attended the same church, which was the Heritage Baptist Church, where they were heavily involved, playing guitar, singing, participating in youth groups, and doing missionary work. David Lee Metzler was born on May 23, 1990, to his parents Susan and Keith, who was a doctor in the Lynchburg area. He also grew up in a tight-knit family with three older sisters. David attended Brookville High School, where he played soccer and was well-liked by his classmates and teachers. He was known for being honest and helpful, and like Heidi, he was often described as an innocent soul. After graduating, David went on to Virginia Tech, where he was majoring in industrial and systems engineering. He and Heidi joined a campus group of about 30 students called Campus Crusade for Christ. It wasn't long before David and Heidi were dating, and their families were really happy about the relationship, and many of them believed that after finishing school, more than likely, they would get married. But that never happened. Instead, they were buried next to each other. And all the cases I cover are tragic and they upset me, but this one really pisses me off because it brings with it a sad realization. No one's safe. You know, there was a time where I would look at people who were homeschooled or would decide to homeschool their children, and I would look at them and think, wow, they're weirdos. Why would you do that? Why would you not have your child in a school system where they can grow their social skills, right? Why would you alienate them from the entire world? And that's my fault. I was wrong. Because the more and more time that passes and the more stories we hear and how dangerous our world has become, I look at them now and I think, man, maybe they got it right. I think about it every day when my kids go to school. And so here's a perfect example where the parents tried to do everything right. They kept their child home, gave them a great education, kept them safe. And the minute they loosened up their grips, excuse my language, but some fucking asshole takes their daughter from them. How do I sit here and tell you that people who decide to homeschool their children maybe aren't onto something here? I got no argument. And this wasn't some major city that was rampant with crime that Heidi went off to. This was a relatively safe community. In fact, this whole situation surprised investigators. They told the Roanoke Times that the Craig Creek Road area was very safe. The only calls they ever got were things like drinking or loud music, not double homicides. And we're going to talk more about the investigation itself, including what evidence has been given to the public as far as where we stand now. But before we get there, let's take a break and we'll be right back. Hey, guess who our next sponsor is? I'll give you a hint. They're helping keep your cats healthy. That's right. Our next sponsor is Smalls, and they make fresh, human-grade food for cats. It's made from the same stuff that you or I would eat, but formulated specifically to help cats thrive. Cats are obligate carnivores who need lots of real meat to stay healthy, but most cat foods out there use meat byproduct and cut their food with cheap grains, fillers, and artificial ingredients. Basically stuff that isn't great for your cat, but big pet food does this because it's cheaper to make. But what they save on costs, your cat pays for with their health. Smalls is different. Their fresh recipes are over 80% animal protein, and they never use fillers or artificial ingredients. Their food is so healthy that 88% of cat parents say that after feeding Smalls, they notice that their cat has better digestion, is softer and shinier, and has way more energy to play. Because it's actually good for your cats. What a concept, right? So if you want to invest in your cat's health, Smalls is giving you 60% off your cat's first order, plus free shipping and free treats for life when you go to smalls.com/detective. That's 60% off your first order, plus free shipping and free treats for life when you head over to smalls.com/detective. This is a great deal. Go check it out. Okay, so we're back. And after David and Heidi were found murdered, investigators spent the day combing the area for evidence. They processed the car for fingerprints and DNA and searched the surrounding fields. If they found anything, they haven't shared that information publicly, even to this day. Investigators also canvassed the area, trying to determine who had been seen in the 24 hours before Heidi and David were found. As far as we know, no one reported seeing or hearing anything suspicious. Investigators then worked to establish a timeline. According to the Roanoke Times, they learned that prior to 8 p.m. on August 26th, Heidi spoke with her parents and told them she was considering changing her studies to pre-med with the goal of becoming a physician's assistant. She asked for their blessing and said she wanted to talk to David about it as well later that evening. Heidi went on to explain that they were going on a date. They planned to go to the campground, start a fire, and then talk for a little bit. and David was going to bring his guitar so that Heidi could teach him some new songs. They didn't plan to camp there overnight because Heidi had a lot of homework. She also had to be at an 8 a.m. meeting with an advisor to talk about her new major. Heidi, as we all know, never made it to that appointment, and her parents would never hear from her again. And so Heidi had that conversation with her parents, and then Heidi and David were seen at her apartment. At around 8 p.m., they left for the campground, and investigators believe that they arrived at approximately 8:25 p.m. They were found murdered 12 hours later. As the investigation continued, detectives came to the realization that the murders were likely random. Unfortunately, they have never explained how they came to this conclusion. And I really would like some more clarification on this. I know they're not going to give it to me, but I'm still going to put it out there. Because, yes, on one hand, you could say that the act was random, where the suspect or suspects didn't know the victims. But how do we know what happened prior to their deaths? It could have been random in the sense where the suspect or suspects show up, there's a brief encounter, maybe there's a disagreement, or maybe there's just words exchanged, and at that point, this is some type of retaliation. And I'm going to revisit this in the perspective at the end, but to me, that wouldn't be completely random. There would be a previous encounter, even though it was only maybe minutes or seconds before, that led to the shooting. And without having the person in custody, I don't know how we get to that conclusion. There is going to be something about the forensics, or I guess I should say how Heidi and David were shot, that I'm going to get to in a few moments. But to me, even if that's the case, this still could be something where there was a previous encounter moments before that ultimately led to the shooting itself. So I wouldn't go all the way out there and say it's random, like somebody was just driving by, pulled in, shot him, and kept on driving. And maybe I'm being a little nitpicky, but I think when we're talking 16 plus years later, we don't want to minimize the scope of the investigation because we're trying to get people to come forward, and they may think that because of what you're saying, they can't help. So my argument to everybody out there, my message to all of you would be, don't automatically assume it's random. The cops don't have anybody in custody, and there's a reason for that. So all options are on the table, and no piece of information is too small. That would just be my two cents. Let's go back to the evening of August 27th, because investigators shared with the public that they had no suspects. They asked anyone who had been in the area within the 24 hours leading up to the couple being found to come forward and speak with police. Additionally, Virginia Tech offered a $10,000 reward. But other than law enforcement saying that they didn't have a suspect, very little information was shared with the public. Police would only confirm that the couple had been shot. They wouldn't release details about evidence, whether anything had been stolen, or what may have been recovered from the scene. Weeks passed, and by mid-September, the sheriff's office was no closer to solving the case. So they formed a 9-agency task force, bringing in multiple federal partners, including the FBI and ATF. Media outlets reported that investigators still believed the killings were random. They were exploring a number of different scenarios and individuals, but the case was suffering from a lack of leads. By the end of the month, police had provided another update stating that they were working overtime, interviewing dozens of people, searching vehicles, and seizing weapons. They had even identified a couple persons of interest, but those individuals were eventually ruled out. So leads were coming in, but investigators said they needed more. They believed there were people out there who may have information, but didn't realize its importance. How often do I talk about this? Regardless of how big or small that piece of information is that you might have, share it. Let law enforcement decide if it's relevant or not. They can't process the information you have unless you convey it to them. So make that phone call, send in that email, go to the police department, and share what you have, because even though it may seem insignificant to you, that could rule someone out, or it could discredit someone's alibi. Just a little detail that you have. It could be a photo or a video. We've had multiple cases where someone has come forward who wasn't necessarily looking to help, but had information that ultimately cracked a case wide open. One of the more recent investigations that I think of is Gabby Petito, where you had a family recording their YouTube video, and their video was critical to solving that case and finding Gabby. So if you're someone who was out in that area during that time, even if you don't think you have anything of importance, it could be a video, a photo, bring it forward, provide it to law enforcement. Worst case scenario, they don't use it. Now, speaking of information, I do want to double back to law enforcement for a second, because up until this point in the story, law enforcement has mainly been asking for information, but they haven't been sharing much. However, as the investigation was unfolding, according to the Roanoke Times, investigators decided to share one additional detail. They stated that the victims did not appear to have suffered any injuries other than the gunshot wounds. Why is this important? What can we read between the lines here? This is my interpretation. What they're trying to convey to us is, hey, our reasoning behind this random act of violence theory is that David and Heidi were surprised. They didn't see the attack coming. They weren't expecting this. This was a random act of violence. And I get it. It's a valid take. I have nothing to dispute it. However, if I'm playing devil's advocate and I'm in a room with these nine agencies talking about the different scenarios, I would pose the argument that what if David and Heidi had a brief interaction with someone or a group of people who had been camping or hunting in the area? It may have just been a quick thing where someone could have made a passing comment to Heidi as they were leaving. And maybe David stuck up for her and responded to these people, and they didn't like it. Now, Heidi and David may have thought it wasn't that big of a deal, and they may have gotten back in the car. But apparently, one person or more than one person in the vehicle of the other car didn't like what David had to say or didn't like what Heidi had to say, and they decided to do something about it. And so while Heidi and David were inside the vehicle, not suspecting anything to come from this brief interaction, they were attacked from behind or from the side of the vehicle. And that's when David was shot and Heidi tried to escape, but unfortunately, she was shot as well. So I guess depending on how you look at this, it is somewhat subjective. You could still classify that as random, but you could also say that from this brief interaction, a motive was developed. And in this particular scenario that I just laid out here, it would be retaliation. The shooter may have felt embarrassed by David or Heidi calling them out, and they decided to make an example out of them in front of their friends, or maybe they were by themselves. And so that could be one reason for them sharing this information. I think it's also to put out there that this wasn't some attack that transpired where they fought back and ultimately they were shot by the end of this. No, this was something where, at minimum, whether it's random or there was a previous occurrence that happened between the shooter and David and Heidi, when the actual attack occurred, it was unsuspected. And so that could be one explanation as to why they put this out there to justify the random act of violence theory. Another part to this equation could be that they wanted the public to know that there was no struggle before this. This wasn't some altercation where there was a disagreement, it got into some type of physical scuffle, and during that encounter, David and Heidi were shot. Clearly, and I'm not disputing it, I agree with this assessment. Regardless of what happened beforehand, Heidi and David did not see the shooting coming. More than likely, in my opinion, David was shot first while Heidi was in the vehicle with him, and your natural reaction is to try to escape, and as she exited the vehicle, she was shot as well. There are a couple other scenarios that could be at play here to explain why Heidi was outside the car and David was inside the vehicle, but I'll get to those during the perspective. And so as you can see, as time's progressing, the agencies working this case are starting to open up a little bit. They're sharing some more information. And make no mistake about it, they're working extremely hard. In fact, the task force said they had developed, followed up on, and closed out more than 1,000 leads. And in some of those leads, persons of interest were identified, but in others, individuals were eliminated or ruled out. And based on everything they had learned, investigators believed that the person or people involved were familiar with the area and more than likely felt comfortable being there. They went on to say that in their opinion, it was likely that whoever was involved, they had a reason to be at Caldwell Fields on that day. Here's another area, and I'm not trying to play devil's advocate, but it's my natural instinct. I don't necessarily agree with this either. We talked about Craig Creek Road, and I even showed you a map of what it looked like, and it could be described as a through route. It's a long, windy road, but it does lead to places like Blacksburg and Newcastle, and so someone could have been passing through there. However, I concede the fact that if you had to put money on it, I think it's more of a possibility that whoever did this was at Caldwell Fields for a certain reason, maybe hunting or camping, and that's why something went down. But then the question becomes, how do you go from going there for camping or hunting and end up murdering two people? What transpired in that short period of time where you went there without knowing David and Heidi were going to be there, and something just flipped in you where you decided, hey, no motive, not going to take them. From what we know, it wasn't sexual in nature. Just going to kill these two people, going to get back in my car, and I'm out of here. To me, that's a stretch. There's something in the middle there that we're missing. And up to this point, nobody has that answer. And that's one of the reasons that the sheriff came out and made another public statement stating, quote, "We're looking at every angle and every direction we can go to try to solve the case. I'm not saying that this case has stalemated, because it hasn't. We just need a couple more pieces of the puzzle to put this thing together." That's exactly what I'm referring to. There's something in the middle there between this person or these people arriving at Caldwell Fields and them shooting two people. What happened in between there? Is this really just a random act of violence where there was nothing that triggered them? They just went over and shot both these kids? The human nature of it all, I need to know more. I need to know the why. And that why was something that was obviously frustrating everybody involved in this case. And no new information would be shared about this investigation until March 30th, 2012, when investigators held another news conference to provide a bunch of new information. They said that they had not identified a motive, but they believe that the couple had been killed sometime between 8:25 and 10 p.m. Now, investigators did not explain how they determined that time frame, but I do agree with them, and I think the assessment is just reasonable deduction. It's just common sense, because we know, based on previous conversations that Heidi had with her parents, that David and Heidi did not plan on staying there long. So if they got there at 8:25 p.m., most likely they would have been home by 10 p.m. And so the fact that they weren't means that they were killed before they would have left on their own. Again, it's a little bit of a guess, but I think it's an educated guess. If they hadn't encountered their killer or killers by 10 p.m., they would still be with us today. So whatever transpired happened relatively quickly after they got there. And when I say relatively quickly, I mean within the hour or two of them arriving. So I do think this is a good window to look at. And when we talk about some other information that was conveyed in just a few moments, this time period becomes significant, especially with some of the witness testimony we have regarding potential vehicles. And although the release of this time frame was important, I think it's relevant when we're starting to try to narrow down the window in which this occurred. To me, it wasn't even the most significant piece of information that they revealed. Because in that same press conference, they let us all know that the weapon used by the suspect was a 30-30 rifle. Again, they did not say how that conclusion was reached, and it remains unclear whether any shell casings were recovered at the scene. My guess would be that there was a shell casing recovered. I don't know how else they would come to this conclusion unless they were able to extract the actual projectiles from David and Heidi, and with a high degree of certainty, they were able to deduce that the weapon was a 30-30 rifle. I think more than likely it is a shell casing. And because they're saying it, I'm going to treat it as fact, because I do want to talk about the 30-30 rifle for a little bit. I wasn't super familiar with it, but I do think there's some fascinating facts about it, which may lead us to a potential suspect. Now, law enforcement hasn't said this. These are just my opinions. So first off, the 30-30 rifle is a lever action rifle that you've probably seen in some of the older movies. It's a lighter weight hunting rifle. It's usually used for mid-size game, although it can be used for black bear in some occasions. But mostly it's used for deer and pigs as well. But the most important piece of information about the 30-30 rifle to me is the fact that it's a low recoil weapon. Why is that significant? Well, the people who are going to gravitate to a low recoil weapon are usually the youth or someone who's smaller in stature. Because in order to shoot something with accuracy, you have to stay on target even after the recoil of that gun. And if it's too much for you to handle, you're never going to hit what you're aiming at. So this is a weapon commonly found by younger individuals who are maybe just getting into the hunting game, or someone who is smaller in stature, just doesn't have the capacity to handle a large caliber weapon. So when we start to think about suspects and persons of interest, although I don't have the list sitting in front of me right now, this is something that you potentially want to look into. Are the individuals you're investigating small in stature? Are they hunters? Are they someone who just got into the hunting game? And are they someone who would gravitate towards a lower recoil weapon because of their size and stature? It's not going to be a home run. It's not going to be the smoking gun, no pun intended, but it's definitely a factor as the investigators you want to consider. And then there was another piece of information that was revealed by law enforcement, which was as, if not more important than the identification of the firearm. And that was the fact that investigators confirmed they had found DNA at the crime scene, but they did not specify what type. Heidi's father did come out later and report to the media that fingerprints had also been recovered. And then he went on to say that the victims had been shot at point blank range. So these are other details that I have to imagine law enforcement had shared with him privately. And for one reason or another, he decided to share it with the public. And so it's probably valid, and it aligns with everything that law enforcement has said so far, that more than likely David and Heidi did not suspect this attack and they were caught by surprise. This is something that nobody's arguing. We all kind of agree with it. My one pushback would be, how did it all transpire? The attack itself could have been something that occurred without them knowing, but it doesn't mean that whoever attacked them, Heidi and David, didn't have just maybe a small degree of familiarity with them. Maybe if it was only just because of a momentary interaction they had 30 minutes prior. That's my only pushback. And one more note about the DNA, because I want to make sure I'm covering all my bases. Investigators noted that residents in that area had been cooperative in providing DNA samples in an effort to find a match. So they're starting locally to see what they can find. And I'm sure over the years, they have expanded that search when it comes to potential DNA matches. Law enforcement ended their press conference by revealing one more important piece of this puzzle. They revealed that Heidi's purse had also been taken from the crime scene. And inside her purse was her credit card, ID card, Motorola Razr cell phone, silver Sony CyberShot digital camera, and her Virginia Tech lanyard. To this day, none of those items have been recovered. And for anybody who was wondering, because I mentioned it earlier in the episode that David was going to bring his guitar, that was recovered at the crime scene. So the offender or offenders took the purse, but left behind the guitar. We have more to cover, including getting into some potential vehicles that were in the area during the time of the murders, and we're going to talk about them right after the break. This episode is brought to you by Pocket Hose, the world's number one expandable hose. Let me tell you right off the rip, I absolutely love this thing. If you've ever dealt with one of those old school hoses, you know how annoying they can be. They kink, they twist, and somehow they always end up fighting you right at the spigot. When you have a hose, it should never take longer to unwind and wind it back up than it takes to actually use it. And that's always the case with my hoses at home, especially the longer ones. And that's why the Pocket Hose Copperhead is such a game changer. To be completely transparent, I was a little skeptical about the claims. When I pulled it out of the package and realized how small it was, I said, there's no way when I run water through this, it's going to shrink back down to this compact size. And yet that's exactly what it did. And I was like, yep, okay, I need three more. That was my first thought. And my second observation, which is also equally important, is the pocket pivot. It swivels 360 degrees, so you're not dealing with the constant twisting and kinking and the loss of water pressure. It actually moves around freely so you can get the job done. And this is something else that people who use a hose a lot know exactly what I'm talking about. If it kinks, it's usually at the spigot, but with the 360 degree pivot, no longer an issue. And like I was saying, when you're finished, this thing shrinks right back down to original size, No winding, no dragging a heavy hose across the yard, screwing up half your mulch. It's lightweight, it's durable, it's anti-burst, and it's rust-proof, and that's why it's backed with a 10-year warranty. So in case you can't already tell, I absolutely love the pocket hose, and I think you will as well. So for a limited time, my listeners and viewers can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size copperhead hose. All you have to do is text DETECTIVE to 64000. That's DETECTIVE to 64000 for two free gifts with your purchase. One more time, that's DETECTIVE to 64000. Message and data rates may apply. See terms for details. Okay, we're back, and before break, I had mentioned that investigators also had identified six vehicles of interest. They were all vehicles seen in the area on the night of the murders. However, investigators emphasized they were not necessarily suspect vehicles. They just wanted to speak with the owners because they may have had information relevant to the investigation. The first vehicle was described as a green sedan, possibly a Ford Taurus or Dodge Intrepid. It was seen stopping in front of the residences along Craig Creek Road at around 6 p.m. The second vehicle was a dark blue Dodge Caravan, which was seen parked near a logging site at around 8:30 p.m. The third vehicle was a dark colored van or minivan, which had been observed at Caldwell Fields after dark. They didn't say what time, if it was after 10 or before 10, just after dark, which to me, depending on when sun set that day, that could be even closer to 8 p.m. The fourth vehicle was a dark colored Ford Crown Victoria or Chevrolet Caprice, which was seen traveling along Craig Creek Road at around 10 p.m. The fifth vehicle was a red or red and white Dodge extended cab pickup with dual exhaust, oversized tires, and tinted windows, which was seen driving up Lee Road at around 11 p.m. directly across from Caldwell Fields. And finally, the sixth vehicle was a gray or cream colored early 2000s Pontiac Bonneville, which was seen parked near Caldwell Fields at around midnight. And before the press conference was concluded, the sheriff delivered a direct message to the person responsible. Quote, "We have DNA evidence. We are actively and aggressively pursuing you. We will not rest until you are apprehended." And listen, personally, I love this statement. It fires me up. It gets me motivated. And I think it does the same for you guys. But you know that old saying, right? Actions speak louder than words. Yeah, nobody's doubting that you're working hard, but if you're going to make a public statement like that, you have to deliver on your promise no matter how long it takes. And after that statement was made, there were a few updates until August 2019, when a full decade had passed without answers. At that point, investigators announced that the Virginia State Police would be taking the lead on the case. The multi-agency task force would begin reviewing all the evidence again, starting from the very beginning, using technology as needed. Investigators also announced a $100,000 reward and said, quote, "We have specific individuals we are interested in pursuing. We have new leads coming in, but we still need the public's help to put the pieces together." And overall, I love this approach. This is exactly what you should be doing after 10 years. I talk about it all the time. If you've been going at it for a decade and you haven't found out who did it yet, it's time to start from square one. Recollect everything, digitize all the information you have, put it all together, bring some new eyes and ears in, and allow everyone to start from square one. Review the case as if it just happened yesterday to see if anything was missed, or based on experiences and knowledge and other cases you may have worked, there may be a new investigator sitting there that goes, "Hey, what about this?" And it may be something so simple, and yet nobody's thought about it before. We've seen it happen time and time again. The only mistake you can make here is having too big of an ego to say, "Hey, you know what? We tried our best. It didn't work, but we got to go back to the beginning and revet everything we already did." It's a daunting task, and it can be really demoralizing, but it's the only right answer. And in addition to doing that, they're also raising the ante with the public, trying to get that public interest once again by saying, "Hey, it's been over a decade, but we're raising the reward. So if you weren't incentivized before, how about 100 grand? So overall, A plus on all fronts. This is exactly how you're supposed to be doing it, regardless of the outcome. 1 year later, in August of 2020, investigators provided another update. They said they had followed up on around 50 new leads since the previous news conference. Investigators thanked those who came forward with, quote, critical information and said, quote, we have been able to advance this case like never before, but there are still those living in Montgomery County who have information related to this case, and I want to appeal to them to please come forward and help us find justice for Heidi, David, and their families. It's been 11 years. Now is the time to do what's right. And so, based on what they're saying publicly, this new task force and this increase in money may have resulted in new leads that could have helped narrow down the suspect pool. However, I'm sitting here talking to you guys, which means one thing. It hasn't resulted in an arrest yet. So, let's fast forward to August of 2025. Around that time, the Virginia State Police provided another update saying the case remains an active investigation. They noted that local, state, and federal law enforcement continue to receive information from the public and the leads are still being followed. According to the Virginia State Police website, investigators have identified, quote, persons of interest and suspects in Montgomery, Craig, and Roanoke counties. Unfortunately, that is the most recent update we have in this case. The murders of Heidi Childs and David Metzler remain unsolved, and their families, along with investigators, are still searching for those responsible. All right, let's dive in this perspective. And we talked about a lot tonight, a lot of information we went over. So I'm not going to sit here and be redundant. I just want to elaborate on some of the things I already said and also give some of my theories about what potentially happened here and what we can do to bring this case to a resolution, finally, once and for all. So first, let's talk about the theories. I'm going to start with the most unlikely. However, you still have to acknowledge it. If I don't, I'm not doing my job. And that would be that there is someone in David or Heidi's life that we're not familiar with who somehow knew that Heidi and David were going to be at this campground that evening. Now, I'm not the investigator here, but one of the things you would have to do with both victims is develop a profile on them to see if there was anybody in either of their lives who would have an axe to grind or didn't like the fact that they were together. Was this someone who was close to them who may have been at Heidi's apartment or knew that Heidi and David were going to the campground just because of a passing conversation? I would imagine that has already been vetted, but I don't know that to be certain. So I'm going to do my due diligence and at least throw it out there, although I don't believe that's a high likelihood in this case. The second would be, again, something also that doesn't necessarily have a lot to support it would be a road rage incident. I don't know what transpired on the way there. Could David and Heidi have cut somebody off, or at least the other vehicle thought that they cut him off? Could they have been driving slow and this vehicle, the suspect vehicle, decided to drive around them and was upset and exchanged some words and then maybe followed David and Heidi to the campground site because David and Heidi didn't think it was that big of a deal? So they pull into the campground, they do their own thing, and then unexpectedly, this person who was in this other vehicle who took it way too seriously gets out of their car and shoots both of them. One of the major issues with that scenario is I don't know where Heidi and David were shot. If it was both in the side of the head or in the back of the head where it would appear to be unsuspecting, that would be less likely, because if it was a road rage incident, more than likely once they saw the vehicle pull into the parking area with them, they would have been on high alert and there would have been some type of struggle, or they would have been shot in the front, or maybe there would have been some defensive wounds or something like that. Additionally, as I mentioned, at least Heidi had a cell phone on her. So if they were being followed or if there was something that made her uncomfortable, I think there was a high likelihood that maybe she would have called her parents. And from what we know, that wasn't the case either. So again, I'm throwing out road rage incident because I'm sure one of you will, which you should. So I'm putting it out there as well. The next one is, and we're starting to get into the more likely category, is that someone who had been at this area, specifically Caldwell Fields, on multiple occasions was already there. They were out there camping, they were out there hunting, or maybe they were just out sitting by a fire, drinking by themselves or with some friends. And after coming back from wherever they were, there was a quick, brief interaction with David and Heidi. And this is kind of one of the scenarios that I laid out earlier, but based on this scenario, as far as the suspect or suspects already being there, two potential scenarios splinter off of that, right? The first one being a brief altercation. Maybe somebody comes on to Heidi and David defends her, or they make a passive comment and there's a brief interaction where maybe David and Heidi don't say anything, but they just ignore them, and that could have enraged or pissed off the other parties, the suspects. That's possible. The second scenario is that there's no exchange. There's no interaction. But this moron, this incel who's basically upset with the world and sees this couple that's clearly, you know, in love or at least likes each other a lot. They see this intimacy and it enrages them and they're jealous. And they've been thinking about something like this for a while. So they go back to their car. They wait until David and Heidi are not suspecting them. And then they get out and they shoot them both without saying a word. And that's why potentially Heidi was outside the vehicle. More than likely, the suspect is going to shoot David first, feeling that he may be the person who can put up the most fight. So they approach on the driver's side of the vehicle, shoot David. And when they do, Heidi's natural reaction is to flee the area, to try to run. And as she's exiting the vehicle, the suspect comes around or even stays on that side of the vehicle and shoots her as well. But based on what Heidi's father has conveyed to the public, more than likely the suspect runs around the vehicle and shoots Heidi point blank range. So those are the two scenarios there. It kind of reminds me a little bit of like the Zodiac Killer, where you have these couples who are frequenting places like, you know, Makeout Lane or whatever that place was called. And these incels, these people who are just mentally demented and doesn't want anybody to be happy, are basically lurking in these locations, hoping that some unsuspecting people show up, their guard is down, and they're able to take advantage of the situation. So that could be what we're looking at here, where maybe the person wasn't camping or hunting at all, but knew that people would go out there at night, couples by themselves, and this would be a potential where they could go there, do what they wanted to do, and get away with it. And up to this point, it's worked. The final scenario that I want to run through is the possibility that this wasn't necessarily something where David and Heidi walked into it. Rather, they were there, and from the street, the suspect or suspects could have seen their car and noticed that nobody else was in the parking lot, and that's why this person decided to pull in. Same scenario, incel situation, something where this person is just looking for a unsuspecting couple to get the jump on, and so this person pulls in, they wait in their car. David and Heidi are preoccupied. They're doing their own thing. Maybe they're out in the woods, or maybe this person sees them walk back. And as they enter their vehicle, this suspect exits their vehicle, walks up to the car, and carries out the same situation that I just laid out a few moments ago. Again, kind of like the Zodiac Killer type thing. And then the final scenario that I'm just thinking about as I'm sitting here, because it's kind of like a catch-all, but I'm sure some of you will call me out on it. Are we talking about a potential transient slash serial killer who's traveling through this area, committing similar crimes, and law enforcement just hasn't identified a pattern? That's always a possibility, but based on the area, it suggests a high level of familiarity with that location to not only carry out this crime, but be able to get out of there without being seen. That's someone who knows what they're doing and knows their surroundings. So those are the main theories that I wanted to run through. Sure, there are more. Some of them are coming to my head as I sit here. But I wanted to discuss the main ones, and I don't want to get too crazy with potentials, because here's the reality. Regardless of how these things transpired, the facts are the facts, and that's that there is at least one person out there who shot these two people in cold blood and is still walking amongst us, more than likely. And so we got to find them, because this may have been an isolated incident. They may have done it again, or they may do it again. So we have a responsibility not only to David and Heidi, but to this entire community and everybody surrounding it to find this person as soon as possible. And you may be saying, well, Derek, it's been 16 plus years. Well, what if in the 17th year, that's when this person decides to reoffend? I don't want that on my conscience. So we have to do something to stop them. And there's a couple things here which are promising. First off, we have the firearm. I've already talked about the potential profile with this person. And excuse me if you're watching on video and I look at my notes, because I kind of developed my own little profile on this person. But based on the gun, based on where the crime occurred, you could be looking at someone who's definitely familiar with the area, possibly a young hunter or camper who has frequented this area before. And as I talked about before with this 30-30 rifle being a low recoil rifle, it could be someone who's small in stature and size. So that's something we have to consider. And I would say that if this person isn't going to come forward, more than likely they have friends or family members who knew that they were out there that day and they had planned on going camping or going hiking or going hunting. And during these hours, they would not have been home. And maybe they did come home eventually and displayed some odd behavior that you just kind of chalked up to them maybe having a bad day. Those are the people we're looking for right now. Those are the people who need to do the right thing and come forward. Yes, it may be a loved one, but your loved one may have killed two people. And regardless of how you feel about this person, as far as how they're related to you, nothing supersedes that. And you need to do the right thing. But if you're not going to do the right thing, that doesn't mean we're at a dead end here. We also have potential ballistics and, more importantly, DNA. Now, I don't know what DNA they have. I don't know if they actually have fingerprints, but they have something, or they wouldn't have said it publicly. And maybe they've already processed it. Maybe there's some financial constraints. I would doubt that would be the case with the FBI involved. However, just to make sure we're covering our bases, if financial constraints are part of this equation at all, and anybody from this multi-agency task force sees or listens to this episode, we can keep it completely confidential. Reach out to me. I will cover whatever funds we need to cover to get the DNA tested. And I also have the connections with different laboratories that may have some technology available that you guys haven't utilized yet. We have had scenarios where the private labs are even better than the government labs. So don't be closed off to that. If something doesn't work out and one lab gives you a certain answer, but you think there could be more, don't be afraid to reach out to me or someone like me and get a second opinion. And like I said, if there's private funds needed in order to get that job done, we're here for you. That's why we do what we do. And as I always say, we can't rely on one thing. Yes, we're exploring the ballistics. Yes, we're exploring the DNA, but we have to have our hands in all the pots, and that includes the community. I know it's been almost 17 years and there has been some movement with the community, but maybe there's someone out there who has that last piece of evidence that we need. Maybe they know they have it, or maybe they don't. We just got to reach them. And maybe this is the podcast that does it. So just to recap, on August 27th, 2009, 18-year-old Heidi Childs and 19-year-old David Metzler were found shot to death at Caldwell Fields, a campground in the Jefferson National Forest, about 15 miles from Virginia Tech. Investigators determined that the couple had arrived at the campground the night before at around 8:25 p.m. and were possibly killed before 10 p.m. Heidi's purse and personal belongings were taken and have never been recovered, while David's guitar was left behind at the scene. DNA was collected, and investigators have identified multiple vehicles of interest seen in the area on the night in question. Despite thousands of leads, a multi-agency task force, and continued advances in science and technology, no arrests have been made. If you have any information in this case, you can contact the Virginia State Police at 540-375-9589. As I said earlier in this episode, there is a $100,000 reward for information. My final words, as always, go out to the friends and family of David and Heidi. No one should have to experience what you guys have gone through, but more importantly, no one should have to go through every day knowing that the person responsible for taking those closest to you are still out there walking amongst us. I truly believe that the investigators working this case are doing their best, but sometimes even their best isn't good enough. But that doesn't mean that we give up. We just have to find another way. We have to figure out the alternate route to get to the solution that we all want, which is to find the person or people responsible for taking Heidi and David from us. Whether that's offering my professional opinion, using this platform to raise awareness about this case, or providing the financial resources to use the latest science and technology available, I'm in for whatever it takes. I want the opportunity to sit right here and let all of you know that the person who killed David and Heidi will never hurt anybody again. Until that day comes, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.
Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Boda Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are,
and that's who we care about.
Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.